Poor Peter. If he should die such a horrible death as the poor slave James had lately done, and all for his kindness in trying to help me, how dreadful it would be for us all. Alas, the thought was familiar to me, and had sent many a sharp pang through my heart. I tried to suppress my own anxiety, and speak soothingly to her. She brought in some allusion to Aunt Nancy, the dear daughter she had recently buried, and then she lost all control of herself. As she stood there, trembling and sobbing, a voice from the piazza called out,
"Where is your Aunt Marthy?"
Grandmother was startled, and in her agitation opened the door without thinking of me. In stepped Jenny, the mischievous housemaid, who had tried to enter my room when I was concealed in the house of my white benefactress.
"I's been hunting everywhere for you, Aunt Marthy," said she. "My missus wants you to send her some crackers."
I had slunk down behind a barrel which entirely screened me, but I imagined that Jenny was looking directly at the spot, and my heart beat violently. My grandmother immediately thought what she had done and went out quickly with Jenny to count the crackers, locking the door after her. She returned to me in a few minutes, the perfect picture of despair.
"Poor child," she exclaimed. "My carelessness has ruined you. The boat ain't gone yet. Get ready immediately and go with Fanny. I ain't got another word to say against it now, for there's no telling what may happen this day."
Uncle Philip was sent for, and he agreed with his mother in thinking that Jenny would inform Dr. Flint in less than 24 hours. He advised getting me on board the boat, if possible. If not, I had better keep very still in my den, where they could not find me without tearing the house down. He said it would not do for him to move in the matter, because suspicion would be immediately excited. But he promised to communicate with Peter. I felt reluctant to apply to him again, having implicated him too much already. But there seemed to be no alternative. Vexed as Peter had been by my indecision, he was true to his generous nature, and said at once that he would do his best to help me, trusting I should show myself a stronger woman this time. He immediately proceeded to the wharf and found that the wind had shifted and the vessel was slowly beating downstream. On some pretext of urgent necessity, he offered two boatmen $1 apiece to catch up with her. He was of lighter complexion than the boatmen he hired, and when the captain saw them coming so rapidly, he thought officers were pursuing his vessel in search of the runaway slave he had on board. They hoisted sails, but the boat gained upon them, and the indefatigable Peter sprang on board. The captain at once recognized him. Peter asked him to go below to speak about a bad bill he had given him. When he told his errand, the captain replied, "Why, the woman's here already, and I've put her where you or the devil would have a tough job to find her." "But it is another woman I want to bring," said Peter. "She is in great distress, too, and you shall be paid anything within reason if you'll stop and take her." "What's her name?" inquired the captain. "Linda," he replied. "That's the name of the woman already here," rejoined the captain. "By George, I believe you mean to betray me." "Oh," exclaimed Peter, "God knows I wouldn't harm a hair of your head. I'm too grateful to you. But there really is another woman in great danger. Do have the humanity to stop and take her." After a while, they came to an understanding. Fanny, not dreaming I was anywhere about in that region, had assumed my name, though she called herself Johnson. "Linda is a common name," said Peter, "and the woman I want to bring is Linda Brent." The captain agreed to wait at a certain place till evening, being handsomely paid for his detention. Of course, the day was an anxious one for us all, but we concluded that if Jenny had seen me, she would be too wise to let her mistress know of it, and that she probably would not get a chance to see Dr. Flint's family till evening, for I knew very well what were the rules in that household. I afterwards believed that she did not see me, for nothing ever came of it, and she was one of those base characters that would have jumped to betray a suffering fellow being for the sake of 30 pieces of silver. I made all my arrangements to go on board as soon as it was dusk. The intervening time I resolved to spend with my son. I had not spoken to him for 7 years, though I had been under the same roof and seen him every day when I was well enough to sit at the loophole. I did not dare to venture beyond the storeroom. So they brought him there and locked us up together in a place concealed from the piazza door. It was an agitating interview for both of us. After we had talked and wept together for a little while, he said,
Mother, I'm glad you're going away. I wish I could go with you. I knew you was here, and I have been so afraid they would come and catch you.
I was greatly surprised and asked him how he had found it out. He replied,
I was standing under the eaves one day before Ellen went away, and I heard somebody cough up over the woodshed. I don't know what made me think it was you, but I did think so. I missed Ellen the night before she went away, and Grandmother brought her back into the room in the night, and I thought maybe she'd been to see you before she went, for I heard Grandmother whisper to her, now go to sleep and remember never to tell.
I asked him if he ever mentioned his suspicions to his sister. He said he never did, but after he heard the cough, if he saw her playing with other children on that side of the house, he always tried to coax her round to the other side, for fear they would hear me cough too. He said he had kept a close lookout for Dr. Flint, and if he saw him speak to a constable or a patrol, he always told Grandmother. I now recollected that I had seen him manifest uneasiness when people were on that side of the house, and I had at the time been puzzled to conjecture a motive for his actions. Such prudence may seem extraordinary in a boy of 12 years, but slaves, being surrounded by mysteries, deceptions, and dangers, early learn to be suspicious and watchful, and prematurely cautious and cunning. He had never asked a question of Grandmother or Uncle Philip, and I had often heard him chime in with other children when they spoke of my being at the North. I told him I was now really going to the Free States, and if he was a good, honest boy and a loving child to his dear old grandmother, the Lord would bless him and bring him to me, and we and Ellen would live together. He began to tell me that Grandmother had not eaten anything all day. While he was speaking, the door was unlocked, and she came in with a small bag of money, which she wanted me to take. I begged her to keep a part of it, at least, to pay for Benny's being sent to the North. But she insisted, while her tears were falling fast, that I should take the whole. You may be sick among strangers, she said, and they would send you to the poorhouse to die. Ah, that good grandmother. For the last time, I went up to my nook. Its desolate appearance no longer chilled me, for the light of hope had risen in my soul. Yet even with the blessed prospect of freedom before me, I felt very sad at leaving forever that old homestead where I had been sheltered so long by the dear old grandmother, where I had dreamed my first young dream of love, and where, after that had faded away, my children came to twine themselves so closely round my desolate heart. As the hour approached for me to leave, I again descended to the storeroom. My grandmother and Benny were there. She took me by the hand and said, Linda, let us pray. We knelt down together, with my child pressed to my heart and my other arm round the faithful, loving old friend I was about to leave forever. On no other occasion has it ever been my lot to listen to so fervent a supplication for mercy and protection. It thrilled through my heart and inspired me with trust in God. Peter was waiting for me in the street. I was soon by his side, faint in body, but strong of purpose. I did not look back upon the old place, though I felt that I should never see it again. 30. Northward Bound. I never could tell how we reached the wharf. My brain was all of a whirl, and my limbs tottered under me. At an appointed place, we met my Uncle Philip, who had started before us on a different route, that he might reach the wharf first and give us timely warning if there was any danger. A rowboat was in readiness. As I was about to step in, I felt something pull me gently, and turning round, I saw Benny, looking pale and anxious. He whispered in my ear, I've been peeping into the doctor's window, and he's at home. Goodbye, Mother. Don't cry. I'll come. He hastened away. I clasped the hand of my good uncle, to whom I owed so much, and of Peter, the brave, generous friend who had volunteered to run such terrible risks to secure my safety. To this day, I remember how his bright face beamed with joy when he told me he had discovered a safe method for me to escape. Yet that intelligent, enterprising, noble-hearted man was a chattel, liable by the laws of a country that calls itself civilized to be sold with horses and pigs. We parted in silence, Our hearts were all too full for words. Swiftly, the boat glided over the water. After a while, one of the sailors said, "Don't be downhearted, madam. We will take you safely to your husband in." At first, I could not imagine what he meant, but I had presence of mind to think that it probably referred to something the captain had told him, so I thanked him and said I hoped we should have pleasant weather. When I entered the vessel, the captain came forward to meet me. He was an elderly man with a pleasant countenance. He showed me to a little box of a cabin, where sat my friend Fanny. She started as if she had seen a specter. She gazed on me in utter astonishment and exclaimed, "Linda, can this be you, or is it your ghost?" When we were locked in each other's arms, my overwrought feelings could no longer be restrained. My sobs reached the ears of the captain, who came and very kindly reminded us that for his safety, as well as our own, it would be prudent for us not to attract any attention. He said that when there was a sail in sight, he wished us to keep below, but at other times, he had no objection to our being on deck. He assured us that he would keep a good lookout, and if we acted prudently, he thought we should be in no danger. He had represented us as women going to meet our husbands in... We thanked him, and promised to observe carefully all the directions he gave us. Fanny and I now talked by ourselves, low and quietly in our little cabin. She told me of the suffering she had gone through in making her escape, and of her terrors while she was concealed in her mother's house. Above all, she dwelt on the agony of separation from all her children on that dreadful auction day. She could scarcely credit me when I told her of the place where I had passed nearly 7 years. "We have the same sorrows," said I. "No," replied she. "You are going to see your children soon, and there is no hope that I shall ever even hear from mine." The vessel was soon underway, but we made slow progress. The wind was against us. I should not have cared for this if we had been out of sight of the town, but until there were miles of water between us and our enemies, we were filled with constant apprehensions that the constables would come on board. Neither could I feel quite at ease with the captain and his men. I was an entire stranger to that class of people, and I had heard that sailors were rough and sometimes cruel. We were so completely in their power that if they were bad men, our situation would be dreadful. Now that the captain was paid for our passage, might he not be tempted to make more money by giving us up to those who claimed us as property? I was naturally of a confiding disposition, but slavery had made me suspicious of everybody. Fanny did not share my distrust of the captain or his men. She said she was afraid at first, but she had been on board 3 days while the vessel lay in the dock, and nobody had betrayed her or treated her otherwise than kindly. The captain soon came to advise us to go on deck for fresh air. His friendly and respectful manner, combined with Fanny's testimony, reassured me, and we went with him. He placed us in a comfortable seat and occasionally entered into conversation. He told us he was a Southerner by birth and had spent the greater part of his life in the slave states, and that he had recently lost a brother who traded in slaves. "But," said he, "it is a pitiable and degrading business, and I always felt ashamed to acknowledge my brother in connection with it." As we passed Snaky Swamp, he pointed to it and said, "There is a slave territory that defies all the laws." I thought of the terrible days I had spent there, and though it was not called Dismal Swamp, it made me feel very dismal as I looked at it. I shall never forget that night. The balmy air of spring was so refreshing. And how shall I describe my sensations when we were fairly sailing on Chesapeake Bay? Oh, the beautiful sunshine, the exhilarating breeze, and I could enjoy them without fear or restraint. I had never realized what grand things air and sunlight are till I had been deprived of them. 10 days after we left land, we were approaching Philadelphia. The captain said we should arrive there in the night, but he thought we had better wait till morning and go on shore in broad daylight as the best way to avoid suspicion. I replied, "You know best, but will you stay on board and protect us?" He saw that I was suspicious, and he said he was sorry, now that he had brought us to the end of our voyage, to find I had so little confidence in him. Ah, if he had ever been a slave, he would have known how difficult it was to trust a white man. He assured us that we might sleep through the night without fear, that he would take care we were not left unprotected. Be it said to the honor of this captain, southerner as he was, that if Fanny and I had been white ladies and our passage lawfully engaged, he could not have treated us more respectfully. My intelligent friend, Peter, had rightly estimated the character of the man to whose honor he had entrusted us. The next morning I was on deck, as soon as the day dawned. I called Fanny to see the sun rise, for the first time in our lives, on free soil, for such I then believed it to be. We watched the reddening sky, and saw the great orb come up slowly out of the water, as it seemed. Soon the waves began to sparkle, and everything caught the beautiful glow. Before us lay the city of strangers. We looked at each other, and the eyes of both were moistened with tears. We had escaped from slavery, and we supposed ourselves to be safe from the hunters. But we were alone in the world, and we had left dear ties behind us, ties cruelly sundered by the demon slavery. 31. Incidents in Philadelphia. I had heard that the poor slave had many friends at the North. I trusted we should find some of them. Meantime, we would take it for granted that all were friends till they proved to the contrary. I sought out the kind captain, thanked him for his attentions, and told him I should never cease to be grateful for the service he had rendered us. I gave him a message to the friends I had left at home, and he promised to deliver it. We were placed in a rowboat, and in about 15 minutes were landed on a wood wharf in Philadelphia. As I stood looking round, the friendly captain touched me on the shoulder and said, "There is a respectable-looking colored man behind you. I will speak to him about the New York trains and tell him you wish to go directly on." I thanked him and asked him to direct me to some shops where I could buy gloves and veils. He did so and said he would talk with the colored man till I returned. I made what haste I could. Constant exercise on board the vessel and frequent rubbing with salt water had nearly restored the use of my limbs. The noise of the great city confused me, but I found the shops and bought some double veils and gloves for Fanny and myself. The shopman told me there were so many levies. I had never heard the word before, but I did not tell him so. I thought if he knew I was a stranger, he might ask me where I came from. I gave him a gold piece, and when he returned the change, I counted it and found out how much a levy was. I made my way back to the wharf, where the captain introduced me to the colored man as the Reverend Jeremiah Durham, minister of Bethel Church. He took me by the hand as if I had been an old friend. He told us we were too late for the morning cars to New York and must wait until the evening or the next morning. He invited me to go home with him, assuring me that his wife would give me a cordial welcome, and for my friend, he would provide a home with one of his neighbors. I thanked him for so much kindness to strangers, and told him if I must be detained, I should like to hunt up some people who formerly went from our part of the country. Mr. Durham insisted that I should dine with him, and then he would assist me in finding my friends. The sailors came to bid us goodbye. I shook their hearty hands with tears in my eyes. They had all been kind to us, and they had rendered us a greater service than they could possibly conceive of. I had never seen so large a city, or been in contact with so many people in the streets. It seemed as if those who passed looked at us with an expression of curiosity. My face was so blistered and peeled by sitting on deck in wind and sunshine that I thought they could not easily decide to what nation I belonged. Mrs. Dora met me with a kindly welcome without asking any questions. I was tired, and her friendly manner was a sweet refreshment. God bless her. I was sure that she had comforted other weary hearts before I received her sympathy. She was surrounded by her husband and children in a home made sacred by protecting laws. I thought of my own children and sighed. After dinner, Mr. Durham went with me in quest of the friends I had spoken of. They went from my native town, and I anticipated much pleasure in looking on familiar faces. They were not at home, and we retracted our steps through streets delightfully clean. On the way, Mr. Durham observed that I had spoken to him of a daughter I expected to meet, that he was surprised, for I looked so young he had taken me for a single woman. He was approaching a subject on which I was extremely sensitive. He would ask about my husband next, I thought, and if I answered him truly, What would he think of me? I told him I had two children, one in New York, the other at the South. He asked some further questions, and I frankly told him some of the most important events of my life. It was painful for me to do it, but I would not deceive him. If he was desirous of being my friend, I thought he ought to know how far I was worthy of it. "Excuse me if I have tried your feelings," said he. "I did not question you from idle curiosity. I wanted to understand your situation in order to know whether I could be of any service to you or your little girl." "Your straightforward answers do you credit, but don't answer everybody so openly. It might give some heartless people a pretext for treating you with contempt." That word, contempt, burned me like coals of fire. I replied, "God alone knows how I have suffered, and he, I trust, will forgive me. If I am permitted to have my children, I intend to be a good mother, and to live in such a manner that people cannot treat me with contempt." "I respect your sentiments," said he. "Place your trust in God, and be governed by good principles, and you will not fail to find friends." When we reached home, I went to my room, glad to shut out the world for a while. The words he had spoken made an indelible impression upon me. They brought up great shadows from the mournful past. In the midst of my meditations, I was startled by a knock at the door. Mrs. Durham entered, her face all beaming with kindness, to say that there was an anti-slavery friend downstairs who would like to see me. I overcame my dread of encountering strangers and went with her. Many questions were asked concerning my experiences and my escape from slavery, but I observed how careful they all were not to say anything that might wound my feelings. How gratifying this was can be fully understood only by those who have been accustomed to be treated as if they were not included within the pale of human beings. The anti-slavery friend had come to inquire into my plans and to offer assistance if needed. Fanny was comfortably established, for the present, with a friend of Mr. Durham. The Anti-Slavery Society agreed to pay her expenses to New York. The same was offered to me, but I declined to accept it, telling them that my grandmother had given me sufficient to pay my expenses to the end of my journey. We were urged to remain in Philadelphia a few days until some suitable escort could be found for us. I gladly accepted the proposition, for I had a dread of meeting slaveholders, and some dread also of railroads. I had never entered a railroad car in my life, and it seemed to me quite an important event. That night, I sought my pillow with feelings I had never carried to it before. I verily believed myself to be a free woman. I was wakeful for a long time, and I had no sooner fallen asleep than I was roused by fire bells. I jumped up and hurried on my clothes. Where I came from, everybody hastened to dress themselves on such occasions. The white people thought a great fire might be used as a good opportunity for insurrection, and that it was best to be in readiness. And the colored people were ordered out to labor in extinguishing the flames. There was but one engine in our town, and colored women and children were often required to drag it to the river's edge and fill it. Mrs. Durham's daughter slept in the same room with me, and seeing that she slept through all the din, I thought it was my duty to wake her. "What's the matter?" said she, rubbing her eyes. "They're screaming fire in the streets and the bells are ringing," I replied. "What of that?" said she drowsily. "We are used to it. We never get up without the fires very near. What good would it do?" I was quite surprised that it was not necessary for us to go and help fill the engine. I was an ignorant child, just beginning to learn how things went on in great cities. At daylight, I heard women crying, "Fresh fish, berries, radishes, and various other things." All this was new to me. I dressed myself at an early hour and sat at the window to watch that unknown tide of life. Philadelphia seemed to me a wonderfully great place. At the breakfast table, my idea of going out to drag the engine was laughed over, and I joined in the mirth. I went to see Fanny and found her so well contented among her new friends that she was in no haste to leave. I was also very happy with my kind hostess. She had had advantages for education and was vastly my superior. Every day, almost every hour, I was adding to my little stock of knowledge. She took me out to see the city as much as she deemed prudent. One day, she took me to an artist's room and showed me the portraits of some of her children. I had never seen any paintings of colored people before, and they seemed to be beautiful. At the end of 5 days, one of Mrs. Durham's friends offered to accompany us to New York the following morning. As I held the hand of my good hostess in a parting clasp, I longed to know whether her husband had repeated to her what I had told him. I supposed he had, but she never made any allusion to it. I presume it was the delicate silence of womanly sympathy. When Mr. Durham handed us our tickets, he said, "I am afraid you will have a disagreeable ride, but I could not procure tickets for the first-class cars." Supposing I had not given him money enough, I offered more. "Oh, no," said he. "They could not be had for any money. They don't allow colored people to go in the first-class cars." This was the first chill to my enthusiasm about the Free States. Colored people were allowed to ride in a filthy box behind white people at the South, but there they were not required to pay for the privilege. It made me sad to find how the North aped the customs of slavery. We were stowed away in a large, rough car with windows on each side, too high for us to look out without standing up. It was crowded with people, apparently of all nations. There were plenty of beds and cradles containing screaming and kicking babies. Every other man had a cigar or pipe in his mouth, and jugs of whiskey were handed round freely. The fumes of the whiskey and the dense tobacco smoke were sickening to my senses, and my mind was equally nauseated by the coarse jokes and ribald songs around me. It was a very disagreeable ride. Since that time, there has been some improvement in these matters. 32. The Meeting of Mother and Daughter. When we arrived in New York, I was half crazed by the crowd of coachmen calling out, "Carriage, ma'am!" We bargained with one to take us to Sullivan Street for 12 shillings. A burly Irishman stepped up and said, "I'll take you for 6 shillings. The reduction of half the price was an object to us, and we asked if he would take us right away. "Troth and I will, ladies," he replied. I noticed that the hackmen smiled at each other, and I inquired whether his conveyance was decent. "Yes, it's decent, it is, ma'am. Devil a bit I would be taking ladies in a cab that was not decent." We gave him our checks. He went for the baggage and soon reappeared, saying, "This way, if you please, ladies." We followed and found our trunks on a truck, and we were invited to take our seats on them. We told him that was not what we bargained for, and he must take the trunks off. He swore they should not be touched till we had paid him 6 shillings. In our situation, it was not prudent to attract attention, and I was about to pay him what he required when a man nearby shook his head for me not to do it. After a great ado, we got rid of the Irishman and had our trunks fastened on a hack. We had been recommended to a boarding house in Sullivan Street, and thither we drove. There, Fanny and I separated. The Anti-Slavery Society provided a home for her, and I afterwards heard of her in prosperous circumstances. I sent for an old friend from my part of the country, who had for some time been doing business in New York. He came immediately. I told him I wanted to go to my daughter and asked him to aid me in procuring an interview. I cautioned him not to let it be known to the family that I had just arrived from the South, because they supposed I had been at the North 7 years. He told me there was a colored woman in Brooklyn who came from the same town I did, and I had better go to her house and have my daughter meet me there. I accepted the proposition thankfully, and he agreed to escort me to Brooklyn. We crossed Fulton Ferry, went up Myrtle Avenue, and stopped at the house he designated. I was just about to enter when 2 girls passed. My friend called my attention to them. I turned and recognized in the eldest, Sarah, the daughter of a woman who used to live with my grandmother, but who had left the South years ago. Surprised and rejoiced at this unexpected meeting, I threw my arms round her and inquired concerning her mother. "You take no notice of the other girl," said my friend. I turned, and there stood my Ellen. I pressed her to my heart, then held her away from me to take a look at her. She had changed a good deal in the 2 years since I parted from her. Signs of neglect could be discerned by eyes less observing than a mother's. My friend invited us all to go into the house, but Ellen said she had been sent of an errand which she would do as quickly as possible, and go home and ask Mrs. Hobbs to let her come and see me. It was agreed that I should send for her the next day. Her companion, Sarah, hastened to tell her mother of my arrival. When I entered the house, I found the mistress of it absent, and I waited for her return. Before I saw her, I heard her saying, "Where is Linda Brent? I used to know her father and mother." Soon Sarah came with her mother. So there was quite a company of us, all from my grandmother's neighborhood. These friends gathered round me and questioned me eagerly. They laughed, they cried, and they shouted. They thanked God that I had got away from my persecutors and was safe on Long Island. It was a day of great excitement. How different from the silent days I had passed in my dreary den. The next morning was Sunday. My first waking thoughts were occupied with the note I was to send to Mrs. Hobbs, the lady with whom Ellen lived. That I had recently come into that vicinity was evident. Otherwise, I should have sooner inquired for my daughter. It would not do to let them know I had just arrived from the South, for that would involve the suspicion of my having been harbored there and might bring trouble, if not ruin, on several people. I like a straightforward course, and am always reluctant to resort to subterfuges. So far as my ways have been crooked, I charge them all upon slavery. It was that system of violence and wrong which now left me no alternative but to enact a falsehood. I began my note by stating that I had recently arrived from Canada and was very desirous to have my daughter come to see me. She came and brought a message from Mrs. Hobbs, inviting me to her house and assuring me that I need not have any fears. The conversation I had with my child did not leave my mind at ease. When I asked if she was well treated, she answered yes, but there was no heartiness in the tone, and it seemed to me that she said it from an unwillingness to have me troubled on her account. Before she left me, she asked very earnestly, "Mother, will you take me to live with you?" It made me sad to think that I could not give her a home till I went to work and earned the means, and that might take me a long time. When she was placed with Mrs. Hobbs, the agreement was that she should be sent to school. She had been there 2 years and was now 9 years old, and she scarcely knew her letters. There was no excuse for this, for there were good public schools in Brooklyn to which she could have been sent without expense. She stayed with me till dark, and I went home with her. I was received in a friendly manner by the family, and all agreed in saying that Ellen was a useful, good girl. Mrs. Hobbs looked me coolly in the face and said, "I suppose you know that my cousin, Mr. Sands, has given her to my eldest daughter. She will make a nice waiting maid for her when she grows up." I did not answer a word. How could she, who knew by experience the strength of a mother's love and who was perfectly aware of the relation Mr. Sands bore to my children, how could she look me in the face while she thrust such a dagger into my heart? I was no longer surprised that they had kept her in such a state of ignorance. Mr. Hobbs had formerly been wealthy, but he had failed and afterwards obtained a subordinate situation in the custom house. Perhaps they expected to return to the South some day, and Ellen's knowledge was quite sufficient for a slave's condition. I was impatient to go to work and earn money, that I might change the uncertain position of my children. Mr. Sands had not kept his promise to emancipate them. I had also been deceived about Ellen. What security had I with regard to Benjamin? I felt that I had none. I returned to my friend's house in an uneasy state of mind. In order to protect my children, it was necessary that I should own myself. I called myself free, and sometimes felt so, but I knew I was insecure. I sat down that night and wrote a civil letter to Dr. Flint, asking him to state the lowest terms on which he would sell me, and as I belonged by law to his daughter, I wrote to her also, making a similar request. Since my arrival at the North, I had not been unmindful of my dear brother William. I had made diligent inquiries for him, and having heard of him in Boston, I went thither. When I arrived there, I found he had gone to New Bedford. I wrote to that place and was informed he had gone on a whaling voyage and would not return for some months. I went back to New York to get employment near Ellen. I received an answer from Dr. Flint, which gave me no encouragement. He advised me to return and submit myself to my rightful owners, and then any request I might make would be granted. I lent this letter to a friend who lost it. Otherwise, I would present a copy to my readers. 33. A Home Found. My greatest anxiety now was to obtain employment. My health was greatly improved, though my limbs continued to trouble me with swelling whenever I walked much. The greatest difficulty in my way was that those who employed strangers required a recommendation. And in my peculiar position, I could, of course, obtain no certificates from the families I had so faithfully served. One day, an acquaintance told me of a lady who wanted a nurse for her babe, and I immediately applied for the situation. The lady told me she preferred to have one who had been a mother and accustomed to the care of infants. I told her I had nursed two babes of my own. She asked me many questions, but to my great relief, did not require a recommendation from my former employers. She told me she was an Englishwoman, and that was a pleasant circumstance to me, because I had heard they had less prejudice against color than Americans entertained. It was agreed that we should try each other for a week. The trial proved satisfactory to both parties, and I was engaged for a month. The Heavenly Father had been most merciful to me in leading me to this place. Mrs. Bruce was a kind and gentle lady and proved a true and sympathizing friend. Before the stipulated month expired, the necessity of passing up and down stairs frequently caused my limbs to swell so painfully that I became unable to perform my duties. Many ladies would have thoughtlessly discharged me, but Mrs. Bruce made arrangements to save me steps and employed a physician to attend upon me. I had not yet told her that I was a fugitive slave. She noticed that I was often sad and kindly inquired the cause. I spoke of being separated from my children and from relatives who were dear to me, but I did not mention the constant feeling of insecurity which oppressed my spirits. I longed for someone to confide it, but I had been so deceived by white people that I had lost all confidence in them. If they spoke kind words to me, I thought it was for some selfish purpose. I had entered this family with the distrustful feelings I had brought with me out of slavery. But ere 6 months had passed, I found that the gentle deportment of Mrs. Bruce and the smiles of her lovely babe were thawing my chilled heart. My narrow mind also began to expand under the influences of her intelligent conversation and the opportunities for reading, which were gladly allowed me whenever I had leisure from my duties. I gradually became more energetic and more cheerful. The old feeling of insecurity, especially with regard to my children, often threw its dark shadow across my sunshine. Mrs. Bruce offered me a home for Ellen, but pleasant as it would have been, I did not dare to accept it, for fear of offending the Hobbs family. Their knowledge of my precarious situation placed me in their power, and I felt that it was important for me to keep on the right side of them, till, by dint of labor and economy, I could make a home for my children. I was far from feeling satisfied with Ellen's situation. She was not well cared for. She sometimes came to New York to visit me, but she generally brought a request from Mrs. Hobbs that I would buy her a pair of shoes or some article of clothing. This was accompanied by a promise of payment when Mr. Hobbs' salary at the Custom House became due. But somehow or other, the payday never came. Thus, many dollars of my earnings were expended to keep my child comfortably clothed. That, however, was a slight trouble, compared with the fear that their pecuniary embarrassments might induce them to sell my precious young daughter. I knew they were in constant communication with Southerners and had frequent opportunities to do it. I have stated that when Dr. Flint put Ellen in jail at 2 years old, she had an inflammation of the eyes, occasioned by measles. This disease still troubled her, and kind Mrs. Bruce proposed that she should come to New York for a while to be under the care of Dr. Elliot, a well-known oculist. It did not occur to me that there was anything improper in a mother's making such a request, but Mrs. Hobbs was very angry and refused to let her go. Situated as I was, it was not politic to insist upon it. I made no complaint, but I longed to be entirely free to act a mother's part towards my children. The next time I went over to Brooklyn, Mrs. Hobbs, as if to apologize for her anger, told me she had employed her own physician to attend to Ellen's eyes, and that she had refused my request because she did not consider it safe to trust her in New York. I accepted the explanation in silence, but she had told me that my child belonged to her daughter, and I suspected that her real motive was a fear of my conveying her property away from her. Perhaps I did her injustice, but my knowledge of Southerners made it difficult for me to feel otherwise. Sweet and bitter were mixed in the cup of my life, and I was thankful that it had been ceased to be entirely bitter. I loved Mrs. Bruce's babe. When it laughed and crowed in my face and twined its little tender arms confidingly about my neck, it made me think of the time when Benny and Ellen were babies, and my wounded heart was soothed. One bright morning, as I stood at the window tossing baby in my arms, my attention was attracted by a young man in sailor's dress who was closely observing every house as he passed. I looked at him earnestly. Could it be my brother William? It must be he, and yet how changed! I placed the baby safely, flew downstairs, opened the front door, beckoned to the sailor, and in less than a minute I was clasped in my brother's arms. How much we had to tell each other! How we laughed and how we cried over each other's adventures! I took him to Brooklyn and again saw him with Ellen, the dear child whom he had loved and tended so carefully while I was shut up in my miserable den. He stayed in New York a week. His old feelings of affection for me and Ellen were as lively as ever. There are no bonds so strong as those which are formed by suffering together. 34. The Old Enemy Again. My young mistress, Miss Emily Flint, did not return any answer to my letter requesting her to consent to my being sold. But after a while, I received a reply, which purported to be written by her younger brother. In order rightly to enjoy the contents of this letter, the reader must bear in mind that the Flint family supposed I had been at the North many years. They had no idea that I knew of the doctor's 3 excursions to New York in search of me, that I had heard his voice when he came to borrow $500 for that purpose, and that I had seen him pass on his way to the steamboat. Neither were they aware that all the particulars of Aunt Nancy's death and burial were conveyed to me at the time they occurred. I have kept the letter, of which I herewith subjoin a copy. Your letter to sister was received a few days ago. I gather from it that you are desirous of returning to your native place among your friends and relatives. We were all gratified with the contents of your letter, and let me assure you that if any members of the family have had any feeling of resentment towards you, they feel it no longer. We all sympathize with you in your unfortunate condition and are ready to do all in our power to make you contented and happy. It is difficult for you to return home as a free person. If you were purchased by your grandmother, it is doubtful whether you would be permitted to remain, although it would be lawful for you to do so. If a servant should be allowed to purchase herself, after absenting herself so long from her owners, and return free, it would have an injurious effect. From your letter, I think your situation must be hard and uncomfortable. Come home. You have it in your power to be reinstated in our affections. We would receive you with open arms and tears of joy. You need not apprehend any unkind treatment, as we have not put ourselves to any trouble or expense to get you. Had we done so, perhaps we should feel otherwise. You know my sister was always attached to you, and that you were never treated as a slave. You were never put to hard work, nor exposed to field labor. On the contrary, you were taken into the house, and treated as one of us, and almost as free. And we, at least, felt that you were above disgracing yourself by running away. Believing you may be induced to come home voluntarily has induced me to write for my sister. The family will be rejoiced to see you, and your poor old grandmother expressed a great desire to have you come when she heard your letter read. In her old age, she needs the consolation of having her children round her. Doubtless you have heard of the death of your aunt. She was a faithful servant and a faithful member of the Episcopal Church. In her Christian life, she taught us how to live, and oh, too high the price of knowledge, she taught us how to die. Could you have seen us round her deathbed with her mother, all mingling our tears in one common stream, you would have thought the same heartfelt tie existed between a master and a servant as between a mother and her child. But this subject is too painful to dwell upon. I must bring my letter to a close. If you are contented to stay away from your old grandmother, your child, and the friends who love you, stay where you are. We shall never trouble ourselves to apprehend you. But should you prefer to come home, we will do all that we can to make you happy. If you do not wish to remain in the family, I know that Father, by our persuasion, will be induced to let you be purchased by any person you may choose in our community. You will please answer this as soon as possible and let us know your decision. Sister sends much love to you. In the meantime, believe me your sincere friend and well-wisher. This letter was signed by Emily's brother, who was as yet a mere lad. I knew by the style that it was not written by a person of his age, and though the writing was disguised, I had been made too unhappy by it, in former years, not to recognize at once the hand of Dr. Flint. Oh, the hypocrisy of slaveholders! Did the old fox suppose I was goose enough to go into such a trap? Verily, he relied too much on the stupidity of the African race. I did not return the family of Flints any thanks for their cordial invitation, a remissness for which I was no doubt charged with base ingratitude. Not long afterwards, I received a letter from one of my friends at the South, informing me that Dr. Flint was about to visit the North. The letter had been delayed, and I supposed he might be already on the way. Mrs. Bruce did not know I was a fugitive. I told her that important business called me to Boston, where my brother then was, and asked permission to bring a friend to supply my place as nurse for a fortnight. I started on my journey immediately, and as soon as I arrived, I wrote to my grandmother that if Benny came, he must be sent to Boston. I knew she was only waiting for a good chance to send him north, and fortunately, she had the legal power to do so without asking leave of anybody. She was a free woman, and when my children were purchased, Mr. Sands preferred to have the bill of sale drawn up in her name. It was conjectured that he advanced the money, but it was not known. At the South, a gentleman may have a shoal of colored children without any disgrace, but if he is known to purchase them, with the view of setting them free, the example is thought to be dangerous to their peculiar institution, and he becomes unpopular. There was a good opportunity to send Benny in a vessel coming directly to New York. He was put on board with a letter to a friend who was requested to see him off to Boston. Early one morning, there was a loud rap at my door, and in rushed Benjamin, all out of breath. "Mother," he exclaimed, "here I am. I run all the way and I come all alone. How'd you do?" Oh, reader, can you imagine my joy? No, you cannot, unless you've been a slave, mother. Benjamin rattled away as fast as his tongue could go. "Mother, why don't you bring Ellen here? I went over to Brooklyn to see her and she felt very bad when I bid her goodbye. She said, 'Oh, Ben, I wish I was going too.' I thought she'd know ever so much, but she don't know so much as I do, for I can read, and she can't. And, Mother, I lost all my clothes coming. What can I do to get some more? I suppose free boys can get along here at the North as well as white boys." I did not like to tell the sanguine, happy little fellow how much he was mistaken. I took him to a tailor and procured a change of clothes. The rest of the day was spent in mutual asking and answering of questions, with the wish constantly repeated that the good old grandmother was with us, and frequent injunctions from Benny to write to her immediately and be sure to tell her everything about his voyage and his journey to Boston. Dr. Flint made his visit to New York and made every exertion to call upon me and invite me to return with him, but not being able to ascertain where I was, his hospital intentions were frustrated, and the affectionate family, who were waiting for me with open arms, were doomed to disappointment. As soon as I knew he was safely at home, I placed Benjamin in the care of my brother William and returned to Mrs. Bruce. There I remained through the winter and spring, endeavoring to perform my duties faithfully and finding a good degree of happiness in the attractions of baby Mary, the considerate kindness of her excellent mother, and occasional interviews with my darling daughter. But when summer came, the old feeling of insecurity haunted me. It was necessary for me to take little Mary out daily for exercise and fresh air, and the city was swarming with Southerners, some of whom might recognize me. Hot weather brings out snakes and slaveholders, and I like one class of the venomous creatures as little as I do the other. What a comfort it is to be free to say so. 35. Prejudice against color. It was a relief to my mind to see preparations for leaving the city. We went to Albany in the steamboat Knickerbocker. When the gong sounded for tea, Mrs. Bruce said, Linda, it is late, and you and Baby had better come to the table with me. I replied, I know it is time Baby had her supper, but I had rather not go with you if you please. I am afraid of being insulted.
Oh, no, not if you were with me, she said.
I saw several white nurses go with their ladies, and I ventured to do the same. We were at the extreme end of the table. I was no sooner seated than a gruff voice said, Get up! You know you're not allowed to sit here! I looked up, and to my astonishment and indignation, saw that the speaker was a colored man. If his office required him to enforce the bylaws of the boat, he might at least have done it politely. I replied, I shall not get up unless the captain comes and takes me up. No cup of tea was offered me, but Mrs. Bruce handed me hers and called for another. I looked to see whether the other nurses were treated in a similar manner. They were all properly waited on. Next morning, when we stopped at Troy for breakfast, everybody was making a rush for the table. Mrs. Bruce said, Take my arm, Linda, and we'll go in together. The landlord heard her and said, Madam, will you allow your nurse and baby to take breakfast with my family? I knew this was to be attributed to my complexion, but he spoke courteously, and therefore I did not mind it. At Saratoga, we found the United States Hotel crowded, and Mr. Bruce took one of the cottages belonging to the hotel. I had thought with gladness of going to the quiet of the country, where I should meet few people, but here I found myself in the midst of a swarm of Southerners. I looked round me with fear and trembling, dreading to see someone who would recognize me. I was rejoiced to find that we were to stay but a short time. We soon returned to New York to make arrangements for spending the remainder of the summer at Rockaway. While the laundress was putting the clothes in order, I took an opportunity to go over to Brooklyn to see Ellen. I met her going to a grocery store, and the first words she said were, Oh, Mother, don't go to Mrs. Hobbs. Her brother, Mr. Thorne, has come from the South, and maybe he'll tell where you are. I accepted the warning. I told her I was going away with Mrs. Bruce the next day, and would try to see her when I came back. Being in servitude to the Anglo-Saxon race, I was not put into a Jim Crow car on our way to Rockaway. Neither was I invited to ride through the streets on the top of trunks in a truck. But everywhere I found the same manifestations of that cruel prejudice, which so discourages the feelings and represses the energies of the colored people. We reached Rockaway before dark and put up at the Pavilion, a large hotel beautifully situated by the seaside, a great resort of the fashionable world. 30 or 40 nurses were there, of a great variety of nations. Some of the ladies had colored waiting maids and coachmen, but I was the only nurse tinged with the blood of Africa. When the tea bell rang, I took little Mary and followed the other nurses. Supper was served in a long hall. A young man, who had the ordering of things, took the circuit of the table 2 or 3 times and finally pointed me to a seat at the lower end of it. As there was but one chair, I sat down and took the child in my lap. Whereupon the young man came to me and said, in the blandest manner possible, "Will you please to seat the little girl in the chair and stand behind it and feed her? After they have done, you will be shown to the kitchen, where you will have a good supper." This was the climax. I found it hard to preserve my self-control when I looked round and saw women who were nurses, as I was, and only one shade lighter in complexion, eyeing me with a defiant look as if my presence were a contamination. However, I said nothing. I quietly took the child in my arms, went to our room, and refused to go to the table again. Mr. Bruce ordered meals to be sent to the room for little Mary and I. This answered for a few days, but the waiters of the establishment were white, and they soon began to complain, saying they were not hired to wait on Negroes. The landlord requested Mr. Bruce to send me down to my meals because his servants rebelled against bringing them up, and the colored servants of other boarders were dissatisfied because all were not treated alike. My answer was that the colored servants ought to be dissatisfied with themselves for not having too much self-respect to submit to such treatment, that there was no difference in the price of board for colored and white servants, and there was no justification for difference of treatment. I stayed a month after this, and finding I was resolved to stand up for my rights, they concluded to treat me well. Let every colored man and woman do this, and eventually we shall cease to be trampled underfoot by our oppressors. 36. The Hairbreadth Escape. After we returned to New York, I took the earliest opportunity to go and see Ellen. I asked to have her called downstairs, for I supposed Mrs. Hobbs's southern brother might still be there, and I was desirous to avoid seeing him if possible. But Mrs. Hobbs came to the kitchen and insisted on my going upstairs. "My brother wants to see you," said she, "and he is sorry you seem to shun him. He knows you are living in New York. He told me to say to you that he owes thanks to good old Aunt Martha for too many little acts of kindness for him to be base enough to betray her grandchild." This Mr. Thorne had become poor and reckless long before he left the South, and such persons had much rather go to one of the faithful old slaves to borrow a dollar or get a good dinner than to go to one whom they consider an equal. It was such acts of kindness as these for which he professed to feel grateful to my grandmother. I wished he had kept at a distance, but as he was here and knew where I was, I concluded there was nothing to be gained by trying to avoid him. On the contrary, it might be the means of exciting his ill will. I followed his sister upstairs. He met me in a very friendly manner, congratulated me on my escape from slavery, and hoped I had a good place where I felt happy. I continued to visit Ellen as often as I could. She, good, thoughtful child, never forgot my hazardous situation, but always kept a vigilant lookout for my safety. She never made any complaint about her own inconveniences and troubles, but a mother's observing eye easily perceived that she was not happy. On the occasion of one of my visits, I found her unusually serious. When I asked her what was the matter, she said nothing was the matter, but I insisted upon knowing what made her look so very grave. Finally, I ascertained that she felt troubled about the dissipation that was continually going on in the house. She was sent to the store very often for rum and brandy, and she felt ashamed to ask for it so often. And Mr. Hobbs and Mr. Thorne drank a great deal, and their hands trembled so that they had to call her to pour out the liquor for them. "But for all that," said she, "Mr. Hobbs is good to me, and I can't help liking him. I feel sorry for him." I tried to comfort her by telling her that I had laid up $100 and that before long I hoped to be able to give her and Benjamin a home and send them to school. She was always desirous not to add to my troubles more than she could help, and I did not discover till years afterwards that Mr. Thorne's intemperance was not the only annoyance she suffered from him. Though he professed too much gratitude to my grandmother to injure any of her descendants, he had poured vile language into the ears of her innocent great-grandchild. I usually went to Brooklyn to spend Sunday afternoon. One Sunday, I found Ellen anxiously waiting for me near the house. "Oh, Mother," said she, "I've been waiting for you this long time. I'm afraid Mr. Thorne has written to tell Dr. Flint where you are. Make haste and come in. Mrs. Hobbs will tell you all about it." The story was soon told. While the children were playing in the grapevine arbor, the day before, Mr. Thorne came out with a letter in his hand, which he tore up and scattered about. Ellen was sweeping the yard at the time, and having her mind full of suspicions of him, she picked up the pieces and carried them to the children, saying, "I wonder who Mr. Thorne has been writing to." "I'm sure I don't know and don't care," replied the oldest of the children, "and I don't see how it concerns you." "But it does concern me," replied Ellen, "for I'm afraid he's been writing to the South about my mother." They laughed at her and called her a silly thing, but good-naturedly put the fragments of writing together in order to read them to her. They were no sooner arranged than the little girl exclaimed, "I declare, Ellen, I believe you are right." The contents of Mr. Thorne's letter, as nearly as I can remember, were as follows. "I have seen your slave, Linda, and conversed with her. She can be taken very easily if you manage prudently. There are enough of us here to swear to her identity as your property. I am a patriot, a lover of my country, and I do this as an act of justice to the laws." He concluded by informing the doctor of the street and number where I lived. The children carried the pieces to Mrs. Hobbs, who immediately went to her brother's room for an explanation. He was not to be found. The servants said they saw him go out with a letter in his hand, and they supposed he had gone to the post office. The natural inference was that he had sent to Dr. Flint a copy of those fragments. When he returned, his sister accused him of it, and he did not deny the charge. He went immediately to his room, and the next morning he was missing. He had gone over to New York before any of the family were astir. It was evident that I had no time to lose, and I hastened back to the city with a heavy heart. again. I was to be torn from a comfortable home, and all my plans for the welfare of my children were to be frustrated by that demon, slavery. I now regretted that I never told Mrs. Bruce my story. I had not concealed it merely on account of being a fugitive. That would have made her anxious, but it would have excited sympathy in her kind heart. I